Hello, hello, hello. Here's Marlanka with another episode from Sri Aurobindo, The Hour of God. Knowledge. Knowledge is only a relation of matter with matter, and is intrinsically neither different nor superior to the hurtling of atoms against each other, or the physical collision of two bulls in a meadow. The material agents involved and phenomenon produced are different, and therefore we do not call the recoil of one horned forehead from another an act of knowledge or intelligence, but the thing that has happened is intrinsically the same. Intelligence is in itself inert and mechanical, and merely the physiological result of a physiological movement, and has nothing in it psychical or mental in the time-honored sense of the words soul and mind. This is the view of modern scientific rationalism, put indeed in other language than the scientists, but put so as to bring out its logical consequences and implications, but still effectively the modern account of the universe. In that account, the nature of a thing consists of its composition, the properties contained in that composition, and the laws of working determined by those properties. As, for example, iron. Iron is composed of certain elementary substances, possesses as a consequence of its composition certain properties, such as hardness, etc., and under given circumstances will act in a given manner as the result of its properties. Applying this analysis on a larger scale, we see the universe as the composition of certain brute forces working in certain material substances, possessed in itself and in those substances of certain primary and secondary, general and particular properties, and working as a result by certain invariable tendencies and fixed processes which we call, by a human figure, nature's laws. This is nature. When searchingly analyzed, she is found to be a play of two entities, force and matter. But these two, if the Unitarian view of the universe is correct, will someday be proved to be only one entity, either only matter or only force. Now, even if we accept this modern view of the universe, which it is not at all dangerous to prophesy, will have disappeared in the course of a century into a larger synthesis. But there is still something to be said about the presence or absence of intelligence in nature. In what, after all, does intelligence consist? What are its composition, properties, and laws? What in its circumstances is human intelligence, the only kind of intelligence which we are in a position to study from within and therefore understand? It is marked by three qualities or processes, the power and process of adaptation towards an end, the power and process of discrimination between the impacts on its senses, and the power and process of mentally conscious comprehension. Human intelligence is, to put it briefly, ideological, discriminative, and mentally conscious. About other than human beings, about animals, trees, metals, forces, we can say nothing from inside. We can only infer the absence or presence of these elements of consciousness from the evidence collected by an external observation. We cannot positively say, having no internal evidence, that the tree is not a mind imprisoned in matter and unable to express itself in the media it has at its disposal. We cannot say that it does not suffer the reactions of pleasure and pain. But from the external evidence, we infer to the contrary. Our negative conclusion is probable, but it is not certain. It may be itself negative in the future march of knowledge. But still, taking the evidence as it stands, what are the facts we actually arrive at in this comparison of intelligent and non-intelligent nature? First, nature possesses in a far higher degree than man the teleological faculty and process. Teleology, incidentally, is the explanation of phenomena by the purpose they serve rather than by postulated causes. To place an aim before one, to combine, adapt, modify, unify, vary means and processes in order to attain that end, means to struggle against and overcome difficulties, to devise means to circumvent difficulties when they cannot be overcome. So this is one of the noblest and divinest parts of human intelligence. But its action in man is only a specialty of its universal action in nature. She works it out in man partly through reason, in animals with very little and rudimentary reason, mainly through instinct, memory, impulse, sensation, and in plants and other objects with very little and rudimentary reason, mainly through impulse and mechanical, or, as we call it, involuntary action. But throughout, there is the end and the adaptation to the end, and throughout, the same basic means are used. For in man also, it is only for a selection of his ends and processes that the reason is used. For the greater part, she uses the animal means, memory, impulse, sensation, instinct, instincts differently directed, less decisive and more general than the animal instincts, but still, in the end, and for their purpose as sure. And for yet another part, she uses the same merely mechanical impulse and involuntary action precisely as in her mistermed inanimate forms of existence. Let us not say that the prodigality of nature, her squandering of materials, her frequent failure, her apparent freaks and gamblings are signs of purposelessness and absence of intelligence. Man, with his reason, is guilty of the same latches and wanderings. But neither man nor nature is therefore without purpose or unintelligent. It is nature who compels man himself to be other than too strenuously utilitarian. For she knows better than the economist and the utilitarian philosopher. She, nature, is an universal intelligence, and she has to attend not only in the sum, but in each detail, to the universal as well as to the particular effect. She has to work out each detail with her eye on the group, and not only on the group, but the whole kind, and not only on the whole kind, but the whole world of species. Man, a particular intelligence limited by his reason, is incapable of this largeness. He puts his particular ends in the forefront, and neither sees where absorption in them hurts his general well-being, nor can divine where they clash with universal purpose. Now, nature, her failures have an utility, and we shall see before long how great a utility. And her freaks have a hidden seriousness. And yet, above all, she remembers that beyond all formal ends, her one great object is the working out of universal delight, founded on arrangement as a means, but exceeding its means. And towards that delight she moves. She takes delight on the way. She takes delight in the work. She takes delight too beyond the work. But in all this, we can anticipate, we speak as if nature were self-conscious. What we have arrived at is that nature is teleological, more widely than man, more perfectly than man. And man himself is only teleological because of that in nature and by the same elementary means and processes as the animal and the plant, though with additions of fresh means peculiar to mind. Now this, it may be said, does not constitute intelligence. For intelligence is not only teleological, but discriminative and mainly conscious. Mechanical discrimination, nature certainly possesses in the highest degree. Without it, her teleological processes would be impossible. The tendril, growing straight through the air, comes into contact with a rope, a stick, the stalk of another plant, and immediately seizes it as with a finger, changes its straight growth for a curled and compressive movement, and winds itself round and round the sport. And what induces that change? What makes it discriminate the presence of a support in the possibility of this new movement? It is the instinct of the tendril, and differs in no way intrinsically from the instinct of the newborn pup, seizing at once on its mother's teats, or the instinct of a man in his more mechanical needs and actions. We see the moon lotus open its petals to the moon and close them to the touch of the day. Now, in what does this discriminative movement differ from the motion of the hand leaping back from the touch of a flame, or from the recoiling movement of disgust and displeasure in the nerves from an abhorrent sight, or from the recoiling movement of denial and uncongeniality in the mind from a distasteful idea or opinion? Intrinsically, there seems to be no difference, but there is a difference in circumstance. One is not attended with mental self-consciousness, but the others are attended with this supremely important element. We think falsely that there is no will in the action of the tendril and the lotus and no discrimination. There is a will, but not mentalized will. There is discrimination, but not mentalized discrimination. It's mechanical, we say. But do we understand what we mean when we say it? And we give other names, calling will force, discrimination, a natural reaction, or an organic tendency. These names are only various masks concealing an intrinsic identity. Even if we could go no farther, we should have gained an enormous step, for we have already the conception of the thing we call nature as possessing, containing, or identical with the great force of will, placing before itself a vast end and a million complexly related incidental ends, working them out by contrivance, adaptation, arrangement, device, using an unfailing discrimination and vastly fulfilling its complex worth. Of this great force, human intelligence would only be a limited and inferior movement, guided and used by it, serving its ends even when it seems to combat its ends. We may deny intelligence to such a power because it does not give signs of mental consciousness and does not, in every part of its works, use a human or mental intelligence. But our objection is only a metaphysical distinction. Practically, looking out on life and not in upon abstract thought, we can, if we admit this conception, rely on it that the workings of this unintelligent discrimination will be the same as they were the workings of a universal intelligence, and the aim and means of the mechanical will the aims and means which would be chosen by an almighty wisdom. But if we arrive at this certainty, does not reason itself demand of us that we should admit in nature or behind it a universal intelligence and an almighty wisdom? If the results are such as these powers would create, must we not admit the presence of these powers as the cause? Which is the truer rationalism? To admit that the works of intelligence are produced by intelligence, or to assert that they are produced by a blind machine unconsciously working out perfection? To admit that the emergence of overt intelligence in humanity is due to the specialized function of a secret intelligence in the universe, or to assert that it is the product of a force to which the very principle of intelligence is absent? Well, to justify the paradox by saying that things are worked out in a particular way because it is their nature to be worked out in that way is to play the fool with reason, for that argument does not carry us an inch beyond the mere fact that they are so worked out, and one knows not why. At this point, we pause for today, and we'll continue in the next episode next week, God willing. And we thank you for listening, and wish that light may be in your day, in your mind, in your being. Bye for now.
This is Auroville Radio, voices from the City of Dawn.